Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Nehemiah chapter 13, the final chapter of the book of Nehemiah. I will entitle this chapter Nehemiah's Final Reforms. Our context is this. The wall, which Nehemiah was so instrumental in rebuilding, was dedicated in chapter 12. And so we begin now in Nehemiah 13, verses 1 through 3. On that day they read aloud from the book of Moses in the hearing of the people, and there was found written in it that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever enter the assembly of God, because they did not meet the sons of Israel with bread and water, but hired Balaam against them to curse them. However, our God turned the curse into a blessing. So when they heard the law, they excluded all foreigners from Israel. Now, that day does not refer to the day immediately following the dedication of the wall, which we read about in the last chapter. And I've got three commentators that agree with that. This is referring to the day after Nehemiah's return from the Persian court. Now, remember, Nehemiah took two trips to Jerusalem from Persia, from Susa, where he was working for Artaxerxes, the king of Persia. He took one in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, that would be 445/444, and he took another trip in 433. So it's either 444 or 433 that we're talking about here. Let's see why it's 433, not 444. This is Adam Clark. It is most likely that when this dedication was ended, that's in the last chapter, 444, Nehemiah returned to Babylon as he himself particularly marks in verse 6 of this chapter 13. For he did return in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, that's 433. And then after certain days, supposed to be about the term of 1 year, that's a guess, he got leave to return to Jerusalem to see how matters were conducted. And there he found the evils which he mentions in this chapter and which he redressed in the manner he himself describes. Now, the day that is mentioned here in verse 1 is the day that the book of Moses was read aloud in the hearing of the people. So this is probably one of the periodic occasions for the public reading of the law that had started, you recall, when Ezra stood at the water gate. That was back in the book of Ezra in 457. And the book of Moses, which was being read publicly to the people, was the book of Deuteronomy, as the NIV Study Bible says. Probably not the whole book, not the whole Torah, the whole five books. Now, the reading contained a prescription against the Ammonites and the Moabites from ever entering the assembly of God. In other words, from coming into Israel. That scripture can be found in Deuteronomy 23, verses 3 through 4. No Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of their descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord, because they did not meet you with food and water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Beor, from Pethor of Mesopotamia, to curse you. Now we're going to see some marriage with foreigners, including Ammonites and Moabites. We're going to see a lot of corruption in the temple worship here in chapter 13. It's a lot of corruption, and that probably would not have happened in 1 year after the building of the temple and of the wall in 444. And that's why it's logical to presume that this day of the reading of the book of Moses in chapter 13 is referring to the day when Nehemiah came back to Israel on his second trip, 433, not 444. So in that 12 years that Nehemiah was gone, Israel screwed up. While the cat's away, the mice will play. Now, this reading of the law in the hearing of the people, that was a tradition started by Ezra for the returnees. We read in Nehemiah 8:1, and all the people gathered as one man at the square, which was in front of the water gate, and they asked Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had given to Israel, and Ezra read it. That reading was in 444 B.C., and so now in 433 B.C., by then they had a tradition of reading the book of Moses in the hearing of the people. Periodically, I don't know exactly when, but periodically they did that. Now, why did God forbid in the book of Moses, in the law, why did he forbid Ammonites and Moabites from ever entering the assembly of God? Because of what they did on the Exodus. You recall the story. This is at the end of Numbers, in Numbers 23, how the Israelites, having been forced to detour south of the Dead Sea and to go up around Moab, they wanted to go through Moab, but Moab wouldn't let them. And then, to add insult to injury, as they were camped there, the Israelites were, in the plains of Moab, getting ready to cross the Jordan River, doggone if the king of Moab, namely Balak, hadn't hired a Syrian priest named Balaam to come down there to curse the Israelites. So the Moabites earned the wrath of God. And the Ammonites were allied with the Moabites at that time. They were right north of the Moabites, east of the Jordan River and the Dead Sea, those two famous pagan countries over there. And they had showed their utter hostility to the people of God, and so they earned what happened to them. They were not allowed to enter into Israel, and yet the Israelites, as we'll see here, are intermarrying with them. A no-no. Now, Nehemiah says in verse 2, our God turned the curse into a blessing. That's Balaam's curse. He was from Syria up in the Mesopotamian Valley. And he had tried, he had been hired to curse Israel, and instead he blessed Israel. We see that in Numbers 23:8. Balaam says this, how can I curse whom God has not cursed? How denounce whom the Lord has not denounced? Numbers 23:11. What have you done to me? Cried Balak to Balaam. Balak's the king of Moab, remember? It was to curse my foes that I brought you here. Instead, you have even blessed them. So that's just a little historical note that Nehemiah brings up. Nehemiah 13, verses 4 through 5. Now, prior to this reading of the law here, Eliashib the priest, who was appointed over the chambers of the house of our God, being related to Tobiah, had prepared a large room for him, where formerly they put the grain offerings, the frankincense, the utensils, and the tithes of grain, wine, and oil prescribed for the Levites, the singers, and the gatekeepers, and the contributions for the priest. Now, briefly, what's happened here? There is a storeroom somewhere in the courtyard in the court of the priest. Maybe it's even attached to the side of the temple. I don't know. But at any rate, in this chamber, the necessities for carrying out the temple sacrifice were kept. And also the tithes that were given to the Levites. The people had to take a tenth of their grain, their wine, their oil, and so forth. And they had to take a tenth of their produce, their animals, and they had to give. Well, not the animals. The animals wouldn't be kept in a store chamber, but the grain offerings and the frankincense and all that and all those things, the tithes of grain, the wine, the oil. So all of that stuff was supposed to be kept in the storeroom, and then the Levites were to get their living from it so they wouldn't have to go back outside of Jerusalem and farm in order to stay alive. Well, the people had quit giving those tithes to the Levites. And of course, the priest in charge of that chamber were then supposed to take a tenth of the tithes that had been given to the Levites, and they were supposed to support the priest with a tenth of the tenth. They weren't doing that either. So all of that is mentioned here in verses 4 and 5. Now, Eliashib was supposed to be in charge of this chamber with all the goodies. He's called a priest here. He's actually a high priest. Verse 28, he will be mentioned as a high priest. Although it is possible he's an ordinary priest. Adam Clark admits the possibility, but I don't think so. He's a high priest. He's mentioned in a lot of these lists of names that are in Nehemiah. He's omitted from one, interestingly enough. And if I remember correctly, I forgot which list it was, but the speculation was the reason he was omitted was because of this nonsense here. He had married into the Ammonites. Tobiah was an Ammonite, or I should say his family, not him personally, but his family had married into the family of Tobiah. And then he had started shortchanging the Levites and basically screwed up. He was the third high priest after Jeshua, the original high priest. Now this Tobiah, who he was related to now, was the same Tobiah the Ammonite who had opposed Nehemiah before. If you read Nehemiah straight through, you will learn about Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite. Those were two of the most prominent officials of Samaria, the northern kingdom, the northern province, I should say, which is under the Persian Empire, and which was inveterately opposed to the city of Jerusalem to their south. Nehemiah 2:10 says this, when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about it, it was very displeasing to them that someone had come to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel. Yes, it was very displeasing, and they sent envoys back to the Persian king and says, stop this building of the temple. They were constantly fighting the Israelites, and doggone if the high priest had married into the family of the Ammonites. Here's what John Gill says, Tobiah remained well connected in Jerusalem despite Nehemiah's strong feelings against him. When Nehemiah returned to Persia, Tobiah apparently used his influence over various nobles who owed him favors. He wheedled his way not just back into Jerusalem, but into a large apartment in the very temple of God. Eliashib, the high priest, was obviously part of this conspiracy and may have been related to Tobiah by marriage. Gill further goes on to say how he was related. It is stated in Nehemiah 6, verse 18, that Tobiah had married a daughter of Shechaniah, who was a Jewish person. And so he had a Jewish father-in-law. And then this daughter and Tobiah had a son. And that son married a daughter of Meshulam, who was another Jewish person. And so that means he was related by marriage to the Jews. Tobiah was, and his son was related to the Jews by marriage. And both of them were priests, Eliashib and his son. So, bad business. Now, Jamison Fawcett Brown says of this large room that had been converted from the storage of goods to support the Levites and the priest into a private apartment for an Ammonite pagan. Here's what Jamison Fawcett Brown say about this large room. Quote, to accommodate so important a person as Tobiah on his occasional visits to Jerusalem, Eliashib had provided him a splendid apartment in the temple. The introduction of so gross an impropriety can be accounted for in no other way than by supposing that in the absence of the priest and the cessation of the services, the temple was regarded as a common public building, which might, in the circumstances, be appropriated as a palatial residence. In other words, it was a hotel for pagans. It was not the holy temple of God. We go down to Nehemiah 13, verses 6 through 9. Nehemiah continues, but during all this time I was not in Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, who ruled from 465 to 424. In the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had gone to the king. After some time, this is Nehemiah's second trip. Well, it's his return to Persia right before his second trip back to Jerusalem. After some time, however, I asked leave from the king from Artaxerxes, and I came to Jerusalem and learned about the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah by preparing a room for him in the courts of the house of God. It was very displeasing to me, so I threw all of Tobiah's household goods out of the room. Then I gave an order, and they cleansed the rooms, and I returned there the utensils of the house of God with the grain offerings and the frankincense. I used to manage an apartment complex and had to rely on the arm of the law to get a distraint, which was a legal process to rid a delinquent tenant of his possessions, to get them out of the apartment, and the sheriff would come and just throw the goods right out on the street, right out the windows. I couldn't believe it. I actually saw this done. That's what it reminds me of when I see here, except Nehemiah didn't use any legal process. He just went in there and says, bam, out you go. Well, we're not going to fault him for that. He was the governor, and it was illegal to use a temple room for a private residence. So I don't feel too bad about him doing that. Now, this 32nd year of Artaxerxes, that refers to Nehemiah having gone back to Jerusalem after having governed, having gone back to Persia, having governed in Jerusalem for 12 years. The way you get these dates, Artaxerxes ruled in 465. So in the 20th year, Nehemiah went the first time to Jerusalem. 465 minus 20 is 445 or 444. And then in the 32nd year, he goes back to Persia the second time. So 465 minus 32 is 433. So the easiest way to remember Nehemiah's two trips is 444 and 433, double digits. Now, Artaxerxes in verse 6 is called king of Babylon. Remember now, the Babylonian Empire is gone. The Persians conquered it in 539 B.C., and we are already in 433 B.C., so why does the text say he's king of Babylon? Well, it's because Babylon was a province of Assyria, and so what Nehemiah is saying, he's king of Babylon. Of course he's king of Babylon, because he's the king of Persia, and Persia is over Babylon. Now, the text says that after some time of staying in Susa on his return in 433, how long was that? Gill speculates that it's less than a year. Clark says definitely he was gone 1 year. Nobody knows. He asks for leave, and he goes back to Jerusalem. Now, when he comes back and sees Tobiah in the room in the temple courtyard, he not only saw that the temple had been profaned and polluted, he also saw that Eliashib had put an enemy of Israel and a personal enemy of Nehemiah in the very precincts of the temple. And so, naturally, he was upset. So he gave the order, they cleansed the rooms. Now that could mean that Nehemiah's servants physically cleaned the rooms, which I'm sure they needed to do, but most probably it means they ceremonially cleansed the room. John Gill speculates they used the water of separation. We find that in Numbers 19:9. Finally, a man who is clean shall gather up the ashes of the heifer and deposit them in a clean place outside the camp. There they are to be kept for preparing lustral water for the Israelite community. So in other words, they take the ashes of the heifer, mix it with the water. The ashes were kept in a clean place outside the camp. They mix the ashes with water, and then when they needed to purify something, sprinkle something to purify it, like a leper, or cleanse someone after they cleanse things after someone had died and polluted the room that the corpse was in and that kind of thing, they'd sprinkle water with ashes of the heifer to purify that which had been Levitically made unholy. And that's probably what they did here, sprinkled the room with heifer water, we can speculate. We go now to Nehemiah 13:10-13. I learned that the Levites had not been given their portions. Remember all that, all those first fruits and tithes that were stored in the chamber there that Elisha was supposed to divvy out to the Levites? He didn't do it. So each of the Levites and singers who conducted the worship in the temple had left for their own fields. They had to farm so they could live. I reprimanded the leaders. Why is God's temple being neglected? I asked. So I brought the Levites back together and put them back in their places of service. So they came back from the countryside, back into Jerusalem, back near the temple, probably in their old homes on the temple wall near the temple. Then all Judah brought a tenth of all the grain harvested, new wine and olive oil to the storerooms. I appointed the following men to be in charge of the storerooms: Shelemiah the priest, Zadok the scribe, Pedaiah the Levite, and I appointed Hanan, son of Zakur, and grandson of Mananiah to help them. Since they could be trusted, I made them responsible for distributing the portions to their relatives. Now who were these leaders that Nehemiah reprimanded in verse 11? They were the priest appointed to look after the storerooms in the temple, John Gill says. Eliashib, of course, was in charge of it. We read that these people were appointed in Nehemiah 12, the last chapter, verse 44. On that day, men were also appointed over the chambers for the stores, the contributions, the first fruits, and the tithes, to gather into them from the fields of the cities the portions required by law for the priests and Levites. For Judah rejoiced over the priests and Levites who served. Yeah, they rejoiced 12 years earlier. They're not rejoicing now 12 years later. So these priests were leaders because they were in charge of the temple, charge of its services, and they were in charge of the storeroom. They were in charge of the finances, in other words. And they screwed up. Nehemiah asked them rhetorically, why is God's temple being neglected? Yes, the temple was being neglected. The service was being neglected to spot the hot, passionate promises the people made 12 years earlier to care for the temple. Let me read you from Nehemiah 10, verse 32-33. We also placed ourselves under obligation to contribute yearly 1/3 of a shekel for the service of the house our God, for the showbread, for the continual grain offering, for the continual burnt offering, the Sabbath, the new moon, for the appointed tithes, for the holy things, and for the sin offerings to make atonement for Israel, and all the work of the house of our God. Yeah, well, talk is cheap. They promised, but they didn't deliver. So in verse 13, we see Nehemiah throwing out these old leaders, because in verse 13 he says, I appointed the following men to be in charge of the storerooms, since they could be trusted, he says. And so the old leaders were booted. These new leaders were made responsible for distributing the portions to their relatives. They were Levites, and the Levites were who were getting shortchanged. We go now to verse 14, Nehemiah 13. Remember me for this, O my God, says Nehemiah, and do not blot out my loyal deeds, which I have performed for the house of my God and its services. Now, you could look at that and take that as sort of a braggadocious statement by Nehemiah. Don't blot out my loyal deeds. In fact, some people have said that this sounds somewhat like Nehemiah is demanding payment for his good works. Reward me for my loyal deeds. Well, no, he's not. According to the NIV Study Bible, he just wanted to be considered a faithful servant. And he felt like he wouldn't be considered a faithful servant if all his previous reforms were wiped out. Do not blot out my loyal deeds. In other words, I rebuilt the wall and I got the temple protected, and now if the whole thing's going to fall down, what's the good of me rebuilding the wall? It'll all be gone. It'll be blotted out from history. I mean, let's look at the New Testament. Jesus, he rewarded his good and faithful servants. Matthew 25:21. His master said to him, well done. This is a parable, but it's referring to Jesus. His master said to him, well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. So Nehemiah is not bragging here. He's just saying, please, God, don't forget what I've done. And there's nothing wrong with that. John Gill agrees with that. He says this, not in a way of strict justice. In other words, getting rewarded for his loyal deeds is not in a way of strict justice, as if he thought he merited anything at the hand of God for what he had done, but in a way of grace and mercy that he would graciously accept thereof, as done for the honor of his name, and overlook all failings and infirmities therein. He would be praying that God would overlook all of his failings and infirmities that might be associated with his loyal deeds. We go now to Nehemiah chapter 13, verses 15 through 19. In those days I saw in Judah some who were treading wine presses. This is Nehemiah speaking. I saw in Judah some who were treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in sacks of grain and loading them on donkeys, as well as wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of loads, and they brought them into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. So I admonished them on the day they sold food. Also men of Tyre were living there who imported fish and all kinds of merchandise and sold them to the sons of Judah on the Sabbath, even in Jerusalem. Then I reprimanded the nobles of Judah and said to them, "What is this evil thing you are doing by profaning the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers do the same, so that our God brought on us and on this city all this trouble? Yet you are adding to the wrath of on Israel by profaning the Sabbath. It came about that just as it grew dark at the gates of Jerusalem before the Sabbath, I commanded," this is Nehemiah speaking, "Nehemiah commanded that the doors should be shut and that they should not open them until after the Sabbath. Then I stationed some of my servants," says Nehemiah, "at the gates so that no load would enter on the Sabbath day." Now this is Jerusalem. Even in Jerusalem, the Sabbath day was being broken. That's the holy city where the temple is. So that shows how slack things had gotten. In verse 18, Nehemiah asked the people, "Did not your fathers do the same? Did not your fathers break the Sabbath? And that brought on the city all this trouble," i.e. the destruction of the city and the invasion by Babylon in 586 B.C. Jeremiah, who prophesied right before that happened, said in Jeremiah 17:21, "Thus says the Lord, take heed for yourselves and do not carry any load on the Sabbath day or bring anything in through the gates of Jerusalem." So Nehemiah is reminding them, they knew, this is what got you in trouble. And now here you are doing it again? Are you crazy? And so in verse 19, "Just as it grew dark before the Sabbath," remember the Jewish day ended at sunset, and the next day began at sunset, and so the Sabbath day began on Friday night, our Friday night. Well, it was their Friday night too, and that would be the Sabbath. And so just as it would get to be dark, he would shut the gates so that nobody could come in, like the merchants from Tyre. Tyre, of course, is on the Mediterranean coast. They would have a lot of fish. They would bring that in, as well as all the people in the outskirts of Jerusalem bringing their wares in, their grain, their wine, their grapes, and their figs, and all that kind of stuff. They were bringing it in, and so he just shut the gate, said, "We're not going to have any commercial transfers take place on the Sabbath day." And then in verse 19, he says at the end, "Then I stationed some of my servants at the gate so that no load would enter on the Sabbath day." So Nehemiah is not trusting the normal gatekeepers. He's got some of his own servants at the gates to keep the Sabbath breakers out. We go now to Nehemiah 13, verses 20 through 22. "Once or twice, the traders and merchants of every kind of merchandise spent the night outside Jerusalem. Then I warned them and said to them, 'Why do you spend the night in front of the wall? If you do so again, I will use force against you.' From that time on, they did not come on the Sabbath. And I commanded the Levites that they should purify themselves and come as gatekeepers to sanctify the Sabbath day. For this also remember me, O my God, and have compassion on me according to the greatness of your loving kindness." Now these traders and merchants outside the walls, they're probably Tyrians. As I mentioned, they were the ones bringing imported fish in. Verse 16. Now, why did they camp outside the walls? Because they were hoping the Jews would come out to them to buy their goods. This reminds me when I taught at a university in China, Shantou University. There was a wall around the campus, and the university forbade any merchant from coming inside the city. So what did they do? They set up their little merchant sheds, their fruit sheds, their peanut sheds, their repair sheds, bicycle repair shops, you name it, and they built a little community. And oh, the restaurants, the food was so good. I even bought a pair of round wire-rimmed glasses outside the gates where I was not supposed to traffic. In fact, I remember one time a university official told me not to eat outside the gate, the east gate. And I said, "Why not?" "Because the restaurants there use digoyo." And what digoyo is, used oil, they skim it off the sewers. And they take that oil and they put it into bottles, and then they take that oil and put it in the food and cook the food with it, and you're going to poison yourself. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it has now been 10 years. I'm still here, and I still have happy memories of that delicious Chinese food that was cooked with such food outside the gates. But, of course, the university was doing this merely for selfish reasons, because they wanted to have their own monopoly stores inside the gates that charged a fortune and provided very little product or service. But this is not the case with Nehemiah. He's trying to protect the Holy Sabbath. So he threatens them. He says, I'm going to use force against you. Scram. He probably did that from the wall, yelled at them in the nighttime. He says, I'm going to use force. John Gill speculates he would beat them. He might even kill them. Clark says maybe he would imprison them. I don't know what kind of prisons they had back then in Jerusalem. I don't know what kind of force he would use. Maybe he could just send some of his militia out there, point their weapons at the merchants and say, scram, get lost. I mean, I don't know if he's going to kill them. Now, verse 22 gives us a verse that's a little bit difficult to understand. I commanded the Levites, Nehemiah did, that they should purify themselves as come as gatekeepers to sanctify the Sabbath day. How is a gatekeeper going to sanctify the Sabbath day, you ask? Well, I ask the same question. Now, first of all, these gatekeepers are not gatekeepers of the city. They're the gatekeepers of the temple. He had other servants taking care of the gatekeepers of the city. We had read that at the end of verse 19. So how did these gatekeepers of the temple sanctify the Sabbath? Well, here's two options. Option number one, this is from Poole and Benson, the commentators. The day that the Levites were to purify themselves was to be the Sabbath day. So we read it this way. And I command, verse 22, and I commanded the Levites that they should purify themselves as come as gatekeepers in order to sanctify the Sabbath day. In other words, when you sanctify yourselves on the Sabbath day, you sanctify the Sabbath day. Option number two, this is Kyle and Delitch. Special Levites were appointed to take care of the doors on the Sabbath in addition to the ordinary doorkeepers. So we would read it this way, and I commanded the Levites that they should purify themselves as and come as gatekeepers, special gatekeepers in addition to the normal gatekeepers of the temple, to make holy the Sabbath day. In other words, to really make sure that nobody got into the temple, carried on some kind of commerce maybe that they weren't supposed to. So I'm not exactly sure what was meant there. It's a minor point. The point is that things are getting purified. And then verse 22, Nehemiah finishes up the verse by saying this, for this also remember me, O my God, and have compassion on me according to the greatness of your loving kindness. Once again, some people say here that Nehemiah is operating too much on the principle of merit and works righteousness. He's saying, tit for tat, God, I did this. I purified the Sabbath, so you do something good for me. That's not what he's doing. This is what John Gill says. That he wished God to remember him for good is sufficiently evident. And who does not wish the same? Good question. But that he expected heaven because of his good deeds does not appear. Indeed, the concluding clause of this verse proves the contrary and shows that he expected nothing from God but through the greatness of his mercy. Shame on those who, with this evidence before them, brand this good man with the epithet of workmonger, a man who, in inward holiness, outward usefulness, and genuine love to God and man, was worth 70 of such self-called believers. Self-called believers. Ooh, that's a little rough, John. Mr. Gill, Dr. Gill, I don't know if he was a doctor, Pastor Gill, a little rough. Come on in, I'll let it go. We go down to Nehemiah 13, verse 23. In those days, I also saw that the Jews had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. So here we go, the same old problem. I think Ezra had to deal with it. I think Nehemiah dealt with it once. I think it's already been twice. We've dealt with marrying pagans, and we're going to deal with it again. Boy, Ezra and Nehemiah would be two great books to use for teaching young Christians not to marry non-Christians. It seems to be a lost art these days. How many broken hearts have I seen from people marrying people that don't follow God? It's a disaster when you do that. Happens all the time, though. So who are these people? Well, Ashdod is a Philistine city. I assume there's still Philistines hanging around even at this late date, although you don't hear about them too much now. But Ashdod is about 10 miles north of Ashkelon. Ashkelon is right there on the Mediterranean coast, and you go about 10 miles north of Ashkelon and go about 3 miles inland, and you get to Ashdod. Those are two of the five famous Philistine cities, Gaza, which is further south on the Mediterranean coast, and then Ashkelon and Ashdod, and then further inland is Ekron and Gath are the other two. So it's a famous place. Let me read you from Easton's concerning Ashdod. The word means stronghold. It's a Philistine city about midway between Gaza and Yappa, and 3 miles from the Mediterranean. It was one of the chief seats of the worship of Dagon, the famous fish god. It belonged to the tribe of Judah, but it never came into their actual possession. It was an important city as it stood on the high road from Egypt to Palestine, and hence was strongly fortified. Uzziah took it, but 50 years after his death, it was taken by the Assyrians in 758 B.C. According to Sargon's record, it was captured by him in B.C. 11, excuse me, not 758 711 B.C. The only reference to it in the New Testament, where it is called Azotus, is in the account of Philip's return from Gaza. It is now called Ashdod, which sounds like Ashdod. So we got some nice, seductive Ashdodite women, and we've also got women from the old enemies of Israel, Ammon and Moab. Ammon is the central eastern portion of the land east of the Jordan, and then you go further south and go east of the Dead Sea, and that's Moab, where Ruth was from. We go now to Nehemiah 13, verse 24. Half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod, or the language of one of the other peoples, but could not speak Hebrew. So we're talking about half of the children of these mixed marriages of Jews and Ashdodites, and Jews and Ammonites, and Jews and Moabites. Why would only half the children speak the foreign language as opposed to the Hebrew language? Why half? Well, I think Adam Clark explains it. He's the only person I've seen to explain it. Clark says that the fathers of these children had both Jewish and pagan wives. And so the Jewish wives would have children, and those children would speak Hebrew because their mothers were Jewish. And then these Jews would also marry, say, an Ashdodite, and that mother would have a child, and she would teach her child the language of Ashdod. I've got another idea. This is totally my speculation. I could be totally wrong. But since children spend most of the time with their mothers, if you had a Jewish mother marrying a man from Ashdod, well, then the Jewish mother would spend more time with the child and would speak it, teach him Hebrew. The father would not teach his child the language of Ashdod. The reason I think this way is because I have seen so many Chinese people marry Americans, and it's always the mother that teaches the second language, or her native language, to the child. The father doesn't get involved with that so much. Maybe that's just an insufficient sample, but that's the way it seems to work in my experience. But if the mixed marriage was this way, where the woman was a Jewish person and married a man of Ashdod, well, then the woman would teach her child Hebrew. But if it was the other way around and the woman was from Ashdod and the man was a Jewish man, then the woman would teach her son or daughter the language of Ashdod. At any rate, the point is that the mixture of the pagans and the Hebrews was messing up the Hebrew language, but much worse than that, if you mix up the language, you're going to screw up the worship of Yahweh also. And that's an old story, is it not? In fact, Nehemiah is going to refer to some of that old story here in Nehemiah 13, verses 25 through 28. So I contended with them, Nehemiah says, and cursed them, and struck some of them, and pulled out their hair. Ah, man, after my own heart. Made them swear by God, you shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor take of their daughters for your sons, or for yourselves. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin regarding these things? Yet among the many nations there was no king like him, and he was loved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, the foreign women caused even him to sin. Do we then hear about you that you have committed all this great evil by acting unfaithfully against our God by marrying foreign women? Even one of the sons of Joiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, was a son-in-law of Sanballat the Horonite, so I drove him away from me. So these people, and I assume they're leaders, married the Ammonites, the Moabites, and the Ashdodites, and so then Nehemiah contends with them. Now, that could be a private contention, but I think Adam Clark is right. He says that he actually proved the fact of these illicit marriages against the iniquitous fathers in a legal assembly where everybody could see it. I remember this is after they promised they would never do that. They promised Ezra that, if you recall. Ezra came over in 458. This is now 433. So we're talking about 25 years earlier, and they've already fallen back into marrying those pagan women. Now, Nehemiah cursed them. Was Nehemiah being a little rough? You know, the modern age is quick to condemn the severity of a punishment while overlooking the severity of the crime. This happens all the time. But these people who married foreign wives were getting exactly what they deserved. They had earlier called down a curse on their heads if they were disobedient. In Nehemiah 10:29, three chapters previous, we read this. The people are joining with their kinsmen, their nobles, and are taking on themselves a curse and an oath to walk in God's law, which was given through Moses, God's servant, and to keep and to observe all the commandments of God our Lord, his ordinances and his statutes. So the people said they took on themselves a curse and an oath. Nehemiah 10:29 says, they said, we're going to walk in God's law, and if we don't walk in God's law, may God curse us. That's what they said. If we don't walk in God's law, what law? They said all the commandments of God, all of the laws, not just some, but included in all those laws is Deuteronomy 7, verses 3 through 4. Furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will quickly destroy you. So, yeah, they were getting what they deserved. It's better to get your beard pulled out or your hair pulled out and getting slapped on the face and getting cursed. Better that didn't happen than have your whole country wiped out. And besides, as the NIV Study Bible says, getting struck probably means that the beating was probably not so much life-threatening as attention-getting. Now, some people say that having their beards pulled out meant that their heads were shaved. I guess that's a translation issue. Adam Clark says that having your head shaven would be a mark of the greatest ignominy. In other words, quite embarrassing. Even if you had your beard pulled out, I imagine it's the same thing. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says, to cut off the hair of offenders seems to be a punishment rather disgraceful than severe. Yet it is supposed that pain was added to disgrace and that they tore off the hair with violence as if they were plucking a bird alive. So wherever they were plucking the hair from the scalp or from the face, I'm sure it was painful and I'm sure it was shameful. Now, Nehemiah uses the example of Solomon to show how marrying foreign wives can pervert the worship of Yahweh. We know that happened to Solomon, of course, very famous example. Here's a speculation as to how Solomon was seduced from Yahweh worship. His foreign wives first come to him and say, you know, Solomon, this is a strange place to us. We don't know who Yahweh is, but we had some gods that we liked back home in Ammon and Moab and Egypt. So if you would just let us build an altar for our God, we're not going to complain about you worshiping Yahweh. Just give us a chance to worship Yahweh. And so then Solomon said, ah, sure, that's not going to hurt anything. So he built some altars for his wives. And then one day he walks by and says, these altars seem very nice. These gods seem very nice. My wives seem to really like them. They're doing very well. I think I'm going to worship them too. Cover my bets. I keep worshiping Yahweh, but I keep worshiping the pagan gods too. And then you have syncretism. Of course, that's the perfect object lesson for the Christian church today. Christian church through all ages has been awfully guilty of syncretism, compromising with the culture. I mean, I never dreamed that I would see in the Christian church morons compromising with woke racist culture, critical racist theory, transgenderism, gosh knows what else, homosexual marriage, quote-unquote marriage. There's no such thing as homosexual marriage because God made them in the image of God, male and female, he created them. But oh no, we got to state the obvious. Got to make an argument against people in the church who ought to know better. Now in verse 28, we read, even one of the sons of Jehoiada, the son of Eliashib, was the son-in-law of Sanballat. Eliashib was the high priest. He was the third one since they had come back in 538. The Israelites had come back to Jerusalem. He was the third high priest, and then he had a son named Jehoiada. We're assuming Eliashib is still alive here. So the son, Jehoiada, was not a high priest yet, but he was in line to take the office of high priest when Eliashib died. Well, even one of the sons married Sanballat. Now, why was that particularly horrible? Well, if you recall, Sanballat, the Horonite, his name was in Moab, so he was a Moabite, and he was one of the two officials that especially opposed Nehemiah in building the wall. The other one was Tobiah the Ammonite. So we got an Ammonite, Tobiah, and we got a Moabite, Sanballat. Both hated Nehemiah, both hated God, And they were both of them intermarried into the Jewish race. Eliashib, the high priest, we've already seen back in verse 4, he is related to Tobiah the Ammonite, and his son, Jehoiada, he's intermarried in, well, he's the son-in-law of Sanballat the Horonite, the Moabite. So the father is in the family of the Ammonites, and the son of the high priest, Jehoiada, he's in the family of the Moabites. So they are totally and utterly compromised with paganism and idolaters. So Nehemiah says, I'm not going to have that. I drove Jehoiada away from me. I drove him away. Don't want to see him. Now, what does that mean, he drove him away? Well, John Gill speculates that perhaps he expelled him from Nehemiah's court, or perhaps Nehemiah banished Jehoiada from the city of Jerusalem. Maybe Nehemiah banished Jehoiada from Judea, from the whole country. Adam Clark speculates that maybe he struck him off. Maybe Nehemiah struck off Jehoiada from the list of high priests. Hard to say, all speculation, but whatever he did, he got rid of him. No more high priesthood for him. Now, Jehoiada had married a daughter of Sanballat, so you wonder why Nehemiah just didn't force a divorce, just like Ezra had done earlier. I don't know. I don't think it really matters. The point is that reform has come to Jerusalem, and that Nehemiah is no wussy-puss. He is a strong man who curses his faithless minions who are supposed to be carrying out God's law. He pulls the hair out of their head or their beard. He breaks up their marriages, or he drives them out of the high priesthood. He pulls out furniture in a room that's been defiled and dumps it somewhere else. I mean, this guy was a great guy. We go now to Nehemiah 13, verses 29 through 31, and we will finish up not only the chapter, but we will finish up the book of Nehemiah. Remember them, O my God, Nehemiah continues, because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites. Thus I purified them from everything foreign and appointed duties for the priest and the Levites, each in his task. And I arranged for the supply of wood at appointed times and for the first fruits. Remember me, O my God, for good. Now, when verse 29, when Nehemiah says, remember them, if you remember somebody, it doesn't just mean to call them to mind. It means do something to them. For example, remember me in your will. That means do something for me. In this case, remember them means do something bad to them because they defile the priesthood. Remember them so that they may be punished. Now, this is an imprecatory prayer. Yet Adam Clark, our faithful Arminian, says that Nehemiah is speaking rather declaratively and not with imprecation. I don't believe that any more than I can fly to the moon. Arminians just can't stand the fact that God has the right to judge sin. They just can't stand it. And maybe because most of evangelical Christianity today in the 21st century is Arminian, perhaps maybe there's a connection between the fact that the current evangelical church is full of wussy-pusses that are afraid to denounce sin. It seems to me that only people I can see that are doing that are Reformed people, and they are in a minority. But at any rate, Nehemiah says, remember them, O God, because they have defiled the priesthood. Now, interestingly enough, this same Jehoiada, who had married the daughter of Sanballat, the Moabite, he did not actually fall under the marriage law of a high priest, as the Cambridge Commentary points out, because he was not the high priest. He was the son of the high priest. But he did violate the spirit of the law because he was the high priest's successor, as the Cambridge commentator also says. We read in Leviticus 21, 13 through 15, the high priest is to marry a woman who is a virgin. He is not to marry a widow, a divorced woman, or one defiled by prostitution. He is to marry a virgin from his own people, so that he does not corrupt his bloodline among his people. For I am Yahweh who sets him apart. Let me repeat that. Verse 14, Leviticus 21. The high priest is to marry a virgin from his own people, not from Ammon and not from Moab. So let's look at Jehoiada. He marries somebody from Moab. He's not the high priest, so no, he hasn't broken the law. But what's going to happen when his father dies and he inherits the high priesthood? He's going to be married to somebody that violates the law. So what is he going to do now? He's going to have to divorce her, I guess. I don't know how that would be solved legally, but it'd be a mess. So, no, he shouldn't have done it. And even if it was a normal person that wasn't a high priest, they shouldn't be, not supposed to be marrying pagans. Are you listening, young single Chinese women? You ain't supposed to marry non-believers. They do it all the time in China because there's so few Christian men in China. at least 70% of the Chinese church is women. Hard to find men when that happens. But I don't care what the circumstances are. It'd be better to be single than to be married to a pagan. All you have to do is look at the divorce courts. Get on the internet and listen to how people moan and groan about how their husbands are so horrible. And maybe their wives are so horrible because they're not believers. We also see in verse 29 that Nehemiah asked God to remember the people who defile the priesthood. Remember them because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites. Now, this is a strange phrase here. What is the covenant of the priesthoods and the Levites? Of the priesthood and the Levites? Well, the Benson commentary says this is a covenant made with Phinehas, who was a priest. He was the famous Phinehas, who participated in the story which I always call the Zeal of Phinehas. Remember when he stabbed Zimri and Cosby, the Midianite woman allied with the Moabites, who was seducing, maybe even with ritual prostitution, but at least was seducing sexually a Israelite man. I can't remember which one is Zimri and which one's Cosby. But anyway, they were getting it on in a tent, and Phinehas very rudely just went right into the tent with his spear and ran him through with a spear. It doesn't say that he did it to them while they were in flagrante delicto, but it sure sounds like it. Makes a great story. We see in Numbers 25:11-13, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, has turned away my wrath from the sons of Israel, and that he was jealous with my jealousy among them, so that I did not destroy the sons of Israel in my jealousy. Therefore say, behold, I give him, I, Yahweh, give Phinehas my covenant of peace. So Phinehas has entered into a covenant of peace with Yahweh, and it shall be for him and his descendants after him, a covenant of a perpetual priesthood, because he was jealous for his God and made atonement for the sons of Israel. So that could be what is being referred to here by Nehemiah, or it could just mean the covenant made with Levi. Now, when I say Levi, I mean the law of Moses as it concerned Levi's son Aaron. All the laws concerning the Levitical priest, they were violated because, as I said, one of those laws said you don't marry foreign women, and that was violated. I think that's probably what it is. What Nehemiah meant when he said the covenant of the priesthood. Now, this covenant of the priesthood is actually mentioned in Malachi 2, verses 4 through 5. Then you will know that I have sent this commandment to you, God says, that my covenant may continue with Levi. So, the covenant with Levi was established in Deuteronomy, when the priesthood, as well as the service of the Levites, was set up in the law. My covenant with him, Malachi 2:5, my covenant with him was one of life and peace. And I gave them to him as an object of reverence, so he revered me and stood in awe of my name. I think that means I gave the Levites to Aaron as an object of reverence. Let me check that. Looking at the context of Malachi 2, verses 4 through 5, I gave the Levites to the priest as an object of reverence. Verse 30 says, thus I, Nehemiah, purified them, the Levites and the priest. I purified them from everything foreign. Now, of course, he's referring to the foreign women. And I suspect that what it means, it doesn't say so, but I suspect that it means he made them divorce them, just like Ezra did. And I, Nehemiah, appointed duties for the priest and the Levites, each in his task. And I arranged for the supply of wood at appointed times and for the first fruits. And that's not a small thing, arranging for the supply of wood. That's not a menial task. You don't have wood, you don't have sacrifices, you don't have a temple service. And wood, I imagine, was not all that abundant in that desert clime. We recall in the previous chapter or several chapters ago, I can't remember, that certain people were assigned the task of delivering wood at different times during the year. That's why it says for the supply of wood at appointed times. And for the first fruits, remember, first fruits of barley, Nisan, Passover, first fruits of wheat. That was at the Feast of Weeks in Sivan, May or June. And then the first fruits of olives and figs and grapes and such. That was at Tabernacles and Tishri, September, October. So all that stuff was taken care of because of Nehemiah, and then Nehemiah once again says to remember, except this time it's remember me, Nehemiah. Oh God, remember me for good. So you can remember somebody, like remember me and my will is something for good. Is Nehemiah pleading on the basis of his good works? We've already asked that question twice. This is the third time, no. Adam Clark says this has precisely the same meaning with, Oh, my God, have mercy upon me, and thus alone it should be understand. Yeah, remember me for good. Have mercy on me. I'm praying for something good to happen to me. There's nothing wrong with that. That's not a bless me religion. Let me go back and read one scripture I left out. I said this supply of wood was arranged for already. Nehemiah refers to that. He's referring back to Nehemiah 10, verse 34. Likewise, we cast lots for the supply of wood among the priests, the Levites, and the people, so that they might bring it to the house of our God according to our father's households at fixed times annually to burn on the altar of the Lord our God as it is written in the law. So they had a lot drawing, and it wasn't only the Levites, but the priests and also the common people brought wood to the temple. It was a big deal. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished the book of Nehemiah. Israel has been reformed. We are in 433 B.C., and that, ladies and gentlemen, is about the latest date you're going to find in the Old Testament. You go much later than that, and you are in the intertestamental period, the Second Temple period, which is past the time of the Scripture. But we still have one book that's in the 400s B.C., and that's the famous book of Esther, and we will take that book up in our next audio. I hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.